product not yet rated.
Welcome to the Lost Pages of Norse Myth. I'm Jason Weiser, your narrator and host of the Myths and Legends podcast. Each month, join me here as we reveal a missing page from the Prose Edda, an ancient manuscript containing all of Norse myth. It's said that these lost pages tell the story of a mysterious god from a distant land and his young son as they embark on a perilous journey across the Norse realms. I present to you now the fifth lost page, The Forging of Leviathan. A lone figure stood before them, tiny in their sight, yet fear coursed through their hearts. He moved too quickly for them to catch, and his sting they knew was mighty. The eldest of the three giants bellowed to the others, "We must flee now, or meet our end." "No, we will stand and fight, brother," yelled back his fellow Jotun. This time, he must be stopped. Before they could act, the cloaked figure flew at them, enraged, and disappeared behind the massive legs of the tallest giant. A thunderous crack erupted as the massive Jotun tumbled to one knee, his other shattered into 100 pieces of broken bone. The giant wailed in pain, his roar echoing through the valley and shaking the trees. The figure taunted them. "You have no chance against Thor, fell creatures, for none can withstand a blow from the thunder god's mighty Mjolnir." He threw back his hood to reveal braided hair and a thick beard. In his hand, a stout hammer, engraved with runes down its short handle, flashed in the sunlight. He leapt forward toward the downed giant, whose head was now low enough to strike. Reaching back, Thor struck the giant squarely across the jaw, sending a hail of enormous gray teeth thudding to the ground. Thor took aim at the giant once more, but this time threw his silver hammer. It whistled, cutting cleanly through the air, flying straight and true toward the giant's head. It struck bluntly at the bridge of his nose. The Jotun's face caved inward, sending sharp bone fragments back into his soft brain, killing him instantly. The giant fell forward in silence, and Mjolnir changed course, soaring back through the air to the hand of its master. The earth shook underfoot with powerful tremors as the remaining Jotun fled, each heavy footstep causing small quakes as their feet slammed into the ground. The Aesir god, Thor, turned with a grim smile and a spark in his eye. Now drunk with power, he gave chase. Untold miles away, deep in an underground cavern in the realm of Svartalheim, two dwarves sat silently at opposite corners of a workshop in disarray. All manner of hammers, tongs, chisels, and weapons hung from the walls, among wooden barrels and iron chests filled with carved trinkets and rare jewels. Empty flagons of ale littered the ground. In the center of the chamber, a great iron anvil and forge stood dark and cold, its fires long extinguished. The thinner of the two dwarves stood up and spoke, his voice frail in the dark. "What have we wrought? What calamity have we unleashed on this world?" The other dwarf, square-jawed and stouter in frame, remained silent, but then smashed his heavy boot on the stone floor, crushing an unusually large spider. "Are you still on about that, Sindri? It's been almost 30 years, and yet you still fret over news of every slain giant." He turned to leave, and then looked back. "Dry those goggle eyes of yours, and straighten your spine, Sobbermouth. What's done is done. It's not just Jotunkind, Brock. You know this," Sindri pleaded. "Thor's bloody campaign knows no bounds and no end, and it's our doing." Brock spat in disgust. "The Aesir are the ones who started this. And it was you who kowtowed to the All-Fatter, the One-Eyed King. We are like ants to him. And yet you had to please him, Wagtail. You had to outdo yourself. This weapon, this lightning hammer for the Thunder God, was your idea, born of your pride. But of our making, together," Sindri shot back. "It is our responsibility, this power we've delivered. We must make amends. It is our duty to restore a balance across these lands." Sindri paused, staring into the darkness. "Are you with me, brother?" For weeks, the brothers Huldra studied ancient dwarven tomes and incantations to set their plan in motion. Sparks flew in the darkness as time-worn grinding wheels sharpened ancient tools. ash-gray coals in the Great Forge were lit anew and began to glow red, then orange, then yellow-white, as Brock's dense muscles worked his wooden bellows. He withdrew a long set of tongs from the oven's fire, swinging a great ball of molten metal onto an immense iron anvil. As he folded the red-hot metal over onto itself, Sindri brought down the heavy hammer in rhythmic time, slowly shaping the metal into the unmistakable head of a great blade. As they worked, the brothers sang a low and somber melody known only to the eldest dwarven smiths. The rhythm of hammer and song helped time pass without heed. But after 2 straight weeks of unbroken labor, Sindri began to wonder what the limits of his brother's endurance might be. It was on this day, the 15th straight since they began their smithing, that a bloated, jet-black spider crept silently from beneath the bench where Brock had earlier crushed its kin. Its long legs skittered across the stone floor, while the fire from the great oven reflected dimly in its 100 sinister eyes. As the brothers finally neared the end of their metalwork, Brock felt a tickle on his leg beneath his thick leather trousers. He knew he must not be swayed by distraction, though he could not help but recall, decades before, as the brothers worked to forge the mighty hammer Mjolnir, 3 times did a menacing gadfly bite Brock in an attempt to derail him from their purpose. The 3rd bite was to his eye, and, blinded by his own blood, Brock momentarily missed the rhythmic flip of his tongs as Sindri hammered. It was enough to deform their careful design. Thereafter, the handle of Mjolnir was foreshortened, a defect never forgiven, but over time forgotten, by the arrogant Aesir gods who received this epic gift. "Not this time," Brock muttered, and again pushed closed his bellows, in time with the singing of Sindri's hammer. Sindri kept his concentration, but looked quizzically at his brother's sudden exclamation. He saw Brock's eyes widen and then glaze over with a white film. Brock had felt a sharp pain on his thigh a moment before. Now, an icy chill numbed his leg, then his torso, and then his heart. Its bitter gift delivered, the spider dropped quickly to the floor, scurrying through an unseen crack in the stone wall. Brock managed one more heave of his wooden bellows before realizing his arms would no longer obey his command. His vision doubled, then blurred, and with weakened knees, he saw the shape of his gangly brother rush forward to catch him as he fell. But it was too late. Sindri caught the full weight of his brother, but his blood had already gone cold. Brock, the Master Smith, was no more. Sindri plodded forward in the dense forest, his steps melting into the soft green earth underfoot. "You could have gone a little easier on the meat pies, my fat friend." He tightened his grip on the thick rope attached to the small wagon behind him. In it, tucked securely under a woolen blanket, patterned with runes, lay the stiff corpse of his brother, Brock, his skin now a sickly, ashen blue. Approaching the shores of a calm, dark lake, he felt the sharp and watchful eyes, the elves of Alfheim, tracking his every step. He was a friend to them, so his only real burden, aside from the sheer weight of his brother's lifeless body, was the not insignificant task of reclaiming Brock's wandering spirit from this place, the mystic Lake of Souls, before it could depart this corporeal realm. Slowly descending from the skies above the trees, hundreds, perhaps thousands, of many-colored orbs of light floated down toward the surface of the lake. These lights, these wisps, were guiding the souls of this world's fallen to their final resting place. As some touched the surface of the water, their light dissipated, creating gentle ripples in the water as they submerged and disappeared, more souls making their way to the other side. Sindri approached the shore of the lake, his brother in tow. Unbinding the blanket, Brock's body was exposed to the cool night air. Sindri stood with unease, wholly unprepared for what was to follow. All he knew was that the dwarven rite of death, a lost ritual that allows dwarven kind to pass on from their physical form, must be interrupted, lest he lose his brother forever. Lifting Brock's stiffened arm, he carefully removed his brother's leather glove, a sacred implement of every dwarven smith. As he pulled the glove over his own calloused hand, he looked into the sullen face of his brother one last time and began to wade deep into the waters of the lake. "Dwarves belong underground, not underwater," Sindri murmured. Then, taking a deep breath, He dove headfirst into the inky black water and disappeared. He swam further and deeper into the lake, where the light of the submerged wisps began to dim in their final descent. Sindri felt drawn toward the light of a pale blue wisp in the distance, which pulsed slowly as he swam toward it. Mesmerized by the blue light before him, Sindri did not notice as a decayed gray hand reached up from below him and locked onto his ankle, and he could not open his mouth to scream. Twisting around, Sindri saw a dimly lit nightmare scene beneath him. The pale hand belonged to a long-dead corpse, still armored and buried waist-deep in the soot-like sands at the lake's bottom. Most of its skin had long since decomposed, or more likely been eaten away by the starving fish and crabs. Long gray strands of hair swayed hypnotically in the water, revealing a sunken, skeletal face and decayed maw half full of rotted teeth, snapping at the chance of fresh prey, which it had no eyes to see. And there were more. Hundreds of partly buried bodies writhed in a sickening dance, flailing their moldering arms in futile fits, driven into frenzy by the rare presence of a living soul and unspoiled flesh. As the sunken horror pulled him closer, Sindri unsheathed his dagger and, in one swift motion, slashed at the hand around his ankle, separating it cleanly from its bony arm. He kicked hard at the face of his ghastly foe, knocking its jaw away into the murky depths and propelling Sindri toward the now bright blue wisp, which he grasped with his gloved hand in a final, desperate act of survival. As he made contact, there was a brilliant explosion of blue light, and a sphere of energy blasted back the encroaching dead, creating a slim path to escape to the surface. Gasping for breath, Sindri emerged, crawling to shore, and spat up thick, black liquid from his lungs. He stood warily, his body trembling in the chill night air. Then an icy, tingling itch crept over his body, as if 1,000 insects had infested his skin. Shivering violently, he felt as if the dead were still clutching and pinching at his body. He brushed away these phantom hands and scratched furiously at his skin and hair, but in vain. He felt no relief. Exhausted, he dropped to his knees, scratching deeply into his soaked flesh until blackness consumed him. He awoke dazed and mustered the energy to crawl toward his wagon, pulling himself up to see Brock's still blue body. He removed his brother's glove and placed his trembling hand on Brock's chest. There, faintly, he believed he could feel a single, slow beat of his brother's heart, and he managed a weak smile. He knew he could never tell Brock of this journey, or share the terror he faced in the Lake of Souls. That would be his burden to bear. Brock woke some days later, in his own bed, unaware that he had almost passed from this world. He sat upright and stretched, looking once more into the familiar face of his brother. It was then that he began to notice a persistent twitch on Sindri's face. Two weeks passed, and the brothers stood side by side in the warm torchlight of their workshop. Before them lay their finished creation, their crowning triumph, a long and sturdy axe of incomparable craftsmanship. The curved, dark wood handle granted perfect balance against the arced blade of the weapon, sharpened to the finish of a razor that would never dull, such as the skill of the dwarves. A series of intricately carved staves adorned the head of the axe, Sindri's final touch, to imbue its design with a potent magical power, unmatched in any realm. Brock grunted. "What, then, do we call it?" Sindri found himself lost in thought. This instrument was born as a mighty foil to the hammer. It will be legend in the hands of an honorable soul. So what is greatest, without equal? And these are 9 known realms. The towering peaks of Jotunheim, the blackest depths of hell, the brightest leaves or deepest roots of the world tree, Yggdrasil, or flights of ravens soaring over Midgard's snow-banked hills. Perhaps the great serpent of Midgard, methinks, offer Brock, he who dwells beneath the sea, and set its body wraps the world. No greater thing could therefore be. Sindri nodded. Then let this blade find trial in a hero's hallowed hand. Let its aim fly straight and true across these ragged lands. Let its purpose find a place high up and further in. Bring us peace and hope once more. Rise now, Leviathan. The fourth lost page has been revealed. Be sure to pay a visit to PlayStation's Facebook page for a look at the weapons of legend in the new God of War. Keep listening now for an interview with Jason McDonald, lead gameplay designer, and Jeet Shroff, lead gameplay engineer, on combat in the new God of War.
Want to introduce yourself and talk about what you do on God of War?
Yeah, I'm Jason McDonald. I'm the lead gameplay designer, and basically focus mainly on Kratos, enemies, bosses, and various design mechanics that are gameplay related.
And I'm Jeet Shroff. I'm the lead gameplay engineer on the project. So I primarily work with design and animation teams on sort of building the implementations and the mechanics of the combat systems, the narrative, the level mechanics, all of the things surrounding the journey that sort of Kratos and the Sun are going on throughout the game.
So Kratos is a Spartan soldier. So combat is truly a part of his character. Can you talk about the importance of this?
Yeah, I mean, Kratos was always introduced as kind of a general of war. You know, that's when you first see him, like in God of War 1, he's, you know, leading soldiers, he's doing that. And then, of course, you know, the events of God of War 1 happened, and then he, you know, started getting angry, started to, you know, resent the gods, and started to resent the Titans, and then that became also a big part of his character. So in this game, I think the Spartan roots of kind of just brutality and getting things done very efficiently and not being afraid to use violence as an end is still a part of Kratos. Okay. I think the interesting thing this game is that now that he has a son, Atreus, with him, he needs to find a way to bring those standards to his son, but not in a way that maybe was as over the top as it used to be.
Yeah, and I think the way I think about it as well is, I mean, that's always been Kratos' character, right? Combat has been very key to him, as well as sort of what Jason talked about, which is this efficiency of combat, sort of being able to be a very skilled fighter and do sort of the most convenient thing to get rid of what's in his way. But now the difference being more what's in his way is really isn't sort of driven by vengeance and revenge and sort of the deeper rooted evils. It's more about sort of an end goal and an adventure with his son, and violence now for him is or combat and using his skills as a way to sort of just protect his son and as they go through this adventure.
So with the son, how does his style differ from Kratos?
Well, Kratos is definitely the brawn of the group. Like he's the strong guy. He's the killer. He's the guy who's still going to be very relentless when he takes out enemies. The son is kind of learning his way. Like I think we will see like whether he could end up kind of like Kratos or where he could go on another path similar to any child. I think the idea for him is that he has more of a magical and Norse connection than Kratos does, because Kratos, as we know, has a Greek history and he's a god, but you know, he kind of is done with that now. And then the son is kind of like, okay, I'm also entering this world. What does this mean for me? How do I deal with this? So basically you'll see him kind of embrace maybe that side of things a little bit more than Kratos, where Kratos is still a very physical person when it comes to combat.
And how does that dynamic translate sort of the combat system?
Well, for Kratos, I think since, of course, the player is controlling Kratos too, is that he's the leader. Like, he's the guy who's going to go in there and make the first move. He's the guy that's going to determine, like, whether a person should die or not. And the son is kind of there following his lead and learning from him and hopefully, like, through combat and gameplay, actually following up on what his father does, sometimes initiating so the father can take advantage. We're really trying to make sure that there's this back and forth dynamic that you can see between the two in gameplay as well as the story, of course.
So you mentioned Atreus and magic. Yeah. Can you talk more about that? Does he have a magical ability, or is there magical power coming from the bow itself?
So for Kratos, he's definitely the physical guy of the group, and he's the guy that is going to get things done through pure strength and brawn, whereas the son, he takes a more magical approach to getting a lot of things done. He's more involved with that sort of the world, where Kratos, as we know, has a bad history with gods and titans and things like that. So he really hesitates before kind of taking on those types of abilities, whereas Sun is new to the world, and he has a different view of these things. He also has a very critical role in this game because the camera is a lot closer to Kratos in our presentation of him. So what that means is that in terms of the crowd control and the things that he could do with enemies in previous games, like your visibility is much shorter now. So the Sun actually is there not just to use magic and show that part of the world, but also be a part of handling the crowd and handling the various threats that enemies deliver on Kratos and the Sun this game. And hopefully through like a dynamic between the two in terms of Kratos doing moves first, the Sun following up, and then vice versa, you get this dynamic where both of them are taking down enemies in the field.
I want to circle back to the game in general. What was the overall tone you wanted to convey in the new God of War combat system?
I think at first, like, we definitely want to make sure that we are doing the same thing that players of God of War series expect. Like, they expect a certain type of direct approach that Kratos has when he actually attacks enemies and he kills them. Like, he's never been a person to hold back when getting things done. But he's also, has changed this game. He has his son Atreus with him. He doesn't need to go as far as maybe he used to do certain things. So basically finding that balance of still achieving kind of the brutality and the fierceness of old God of War combat, but bringing with it a little bit more, I guess, nuance. So whereas, like, in the past, Kratos had a kill, for example, where he would rip an arm off of an enemy, and then he would stab him with the blade attached to the arm. And it was one of those things that, it was very fun to create those moves before, and Kratos will still do a few things like that, but now, we may leave out the frequent stabs after the initial rip. Like, we may just the rip is enough, and he's still getting it done. He's still doing what he did before, but he's doing it kind of in this slightly different way, as opposed to being just super angry and super just relentless when he kills everybody.
His rage this time around is definitely something he's trying to bottle up, as opposed to just unleash all the time, all day, every day. So I think that dynamic was really interesting to sort of develop and play with and provide the player that opportunity to use rage when needed. And from a sort of narrative point of view, when it comes to combat, it is him trying to get control of that and not sort of just have that be his go-to, but use it when absolutely needed for that sense of survival or sense of protection for his son.
Yeah.
So I think that dynamic in combat, trying to figure out how that would fit within the combat system, because in previous games that was the go-to. It was that's the inspiration. Mm-hmm. Now it's, okay, how do we balance that? How do we figure out where that fits? What's the line? How far do we want to go? And that was interesting, trying to figure that out and how we ended up with.
Did him sort of trying to repress his rage come out in any sort of like combat stances or the different ways the character was portrayed in terms of his combat style?
Well, the most direct portrayal of that is the actual rage mode that we have in the game. We've shown that, I think, in the very first trailer for this game, where it's bottling up inside, and then he runs in there and gets things done kind of more of the way Kratos used to in the past. So that meter and that mode is kind of the most direct representation of him bottling up his rage and then using it when appropriate, as opposed to just using it all the time.
Kind of in general, can you talk to how combat systems have evolved in gaming over the last generation of games? Like, what do gamers expect now?
That's interesting, because I remember when God of War, first released, and we were kind of a game very similar to other action games at the time, but God of War was always the more kind of easier to get into, not as technical, and we kind of carried that approach through multiple games in the God of War series, And over time, like, a lot of the games that God of War kind of took inspiration from have changed. Like, combat games aren't like that anymore. Games have evolved into a different beast in having a little bit more tactical presence in terms of what you're trying to do, what you're equipping, what your options are at any moment, and with this new God of War game, we knew that we had to evolve a little bit beyond just kind of mashing buttons. I'm sure everybody who's played a God of War game has experienced a little bit of that, you know. So we want to retain a little bit of it because we don't want to make sure that everybody can pick up and play this. But at the same time, we want to take on a little bit more RPG-like mechanics in terms of what you can equip, what you can find. The game's a lot longer, so there's a lot more things to get. And make sure that also is a very important part of the equation this time, as opposed to just running through and square triangling your way through everything. Yeah. Nice.
And providing sort of player choice as well was a key to our sort of combat experience, maybe not necessarily the system itself. Mm-hmm. You know, bringing the camera in as close as we did, as well as making it free look, allows the player to really have options in terms of where to look, where to see, be tactical to that point. And then being able to switch between the axe, going to to bare hands, pulling the axe back, using the sun, like choice is a big part of this combat system. And you know, how we vary that with the different cast and the different enemies that you encounter, how we vary that with the different environments, providing sort of a little bit more of a grounded experience within the combat as well was a huge part to this iteration. And I think players generally will expect that fast-paced combat that we've always been known for, and we're sort of committed and to delivering that with sort of this added layer of choice and control for the player.
Cool. Okay. So when it comes to weapons, did your team practice with any like real weapons or study with combat experts? Like, did you get to play with axes and stuff?
Yeah, we did have a few people. Like, we always joke at our animation team because they have like basically a barrel full of weapons, and everybody will go up there.
I have a soft sword at my desk right now.
Yeah, and I have a wooden sword that I stole from the animators because they moved a little bit far away from it, so now I can't pick it up and swing it around anymore, so I took one for my own. But basically, there's always been a lot of that in the studio, like a lot of, you know, just getting up, swing weapons around,
awesome.
Getting direct reference. Now that we're mocapping as part of our process now, animators are filming themselves, like, and to swing different weapons, do many things. I mean, for the axe, though, I think the axe was something that Corey wanted right from the start, though. Like, mm-hmm. that is one consistent thing that has not changed in this game. Besides what the axe can do, that has changed, but the axe itself was going to be a primary change to mark the change of this new God of War.
So Kratos has a new shield in the Norse world that dynamically springs into use when it's needed. Was this shield based on any historical design, or is it a wholly new construction for the game?
It actually is a new construction for us. Okay. Like, we previously Kratos didn't have a shield. Like, he was just blocking kind of like he used to. And over time, you know, the idea came up where of this shield that would kind of come out of nowhere. And part of this, I think, was trying to get that Viking feel as well, in terms of having a big shield and having a big weapon. But we knew we didn't want Kratos to walk around with a giant shield all the time. So that's when the idea of it kind of forming on the fly. And I will say that when we first had that idea, like, a lot of people were including maybe this person over here, were a lot of doubt on that idea because of course, because, you know, it's a shield that's coming out of nowhere. Like, why is this happening? Like, how can we sell it? You know, when it was an idea form, there was a lot of questions with it, you know. And I think in this last demo or trailer that we showed for E3, it did something similar to what Jeet was talking about with the axe last trailer, which is that, you know, when that shield popped out, it was one of those moments again where we're like, are people going to like this? Are people going to wonder where it, you know, came from? And it seemed like the feedback on that has been very positive in terms of what it could do. And everybody's asking us, like, oh, what's that going to be capable of? What can we do? So that's something that definitely, like, weren't sure at first if that was going to actually make it into the game, but now it's pretty much a staple part of Kratos' system as well.
Nice. The team is amazing in that way. Where, I mean, I will say this: I hated the shield when it first was introduced in the game, and, you know, I'm sure sort of made it very clear to Jason how I felt about this, and Corey and the rest of the team. But again, the combat team and, you know, the designers, the animators, the programmers, is taking that concept and really, you know, making it be a go-to weapon now. And so it's something that has such a strong foundation in the way Kratos' combat system works and its use and how it interacts with the enemies. And it's definitely blown me away. And so I definitely will eat my words then on this one. And
nice.
And it's definitely enjoyable to use the shield.
So circling back to Atreus, what can you tell us about his bow and arrows? Like, were any other Norse weapons considered for him, or were the bow and arrows always kind of, what were you going to do to kind of complement Kratos' melee style.
Yeah, that was another one of those things, like the axe, like right when Corey pitched this new vision of the game and new vision of the series for Kratos, like the son already had his bow, and that was already something that we were going to start building off of, finding ways to use. I mean, obviously just from like a system design side, like it's nice that he has that, because now he's got range, so he doesn't have to, you know, run up on everybody. He's like this little guy, you know. So just systematically, it's nice that he's got his bow, but it was definitely something that from day one we were like, okay, what can we do with this? What, you know, what abilities can he have? And it goes nice with Kratos, because Kratos, even though he can throw his axe, it's still a primarily melee in-hand weapon, so the son kind of has more crazy abilities when it comes to the range, and that's kind of a balance that has been working well, I think, for the game.
Yeah, I mean, with the sun as well, I mean, that even out of the gate just makes things a little bit more easier for us to deal with, kind of having him be that sort of range character, not always having to be up close with enemies, and sort of getting in the player's way. We didn't really want that. And that's not to say that he's not going to be afraid to like scurry his way through and grab onto guys and, you know, really aid you and help you throughout your combat experience, especially on command. But just giving sort of the player that extension, that range extension, even via the system and how it fits within the combat, it just made things a lot more simpler to achieve.
Yeah. I heard that he's going to have his own button dedicated to him, which on a controller, I mean, there's a limited number of buttons, so that seems like a big deal. What can you talk about, like, how players will use that button?
So as I mentioned before, like, Kratos is kind of the leader in the group, so the idea is that the son, even though he can initiate and do a few things on his own, he kind of saves up his best abilities for what his father will command him to do it. And that's what that button's all about, where using that button to do the most powerful things that the son can do and do it at the moments that the player wants to. Now, we all are trying to make sure that just on his own, he is delivering a lot of his own nuance in terms of what he decides to do on his own. So you don't have to wait to press that button to see the son do cool things. But really, when it comes to like extending combos and just destroying the field of enemies, like depending on when you choose to fire that button or when or who you choose to shoot with it, we're trying to make sure that's an important part of your decision making.
Yeah, and, you know, especially in the combo, like I think the juggles and things like that are something that he can aid to even when you're using the button. And you know, dedicating a button to him is really a testament to the fact that he is an extension of the player and the player's arsenal in combat. And, you know, Kratos is a sort of a stranger in this land. And, you know, we've used the sun and the sun button in a way for us to also extend that to the level mechanics, being, you know, having the sun being able to translate things, having the sun be able to sort of be useful via that button outside of combat, inside of combat, and overall throughout the adventure, start to finish. So,
yeah, it was really important to Corey, and I think all of us, is that you don't want players to forget about the sun, because I think I might have mentioned in the past and in interviews like this where, you know, when the moment of the sun was, you know, talked about, like it was at first like questions across the studio, like how are we going to do this? You know, Kratos never had anybody. You know, are people going to hate this guy now because everybody's used to seeing Kratos alone? You know, so it was really one of those things that we're constantly dealing with in the studio in terms of making sure that he feels useful, making sure that he feels like a part of your game, because the decisions when Kratos actually, you know, wins in fights and he actually gets over his challenges, it's not just him doing it alone anymore. It's the son. Mm-hmm. And since the son has like capabilities that Kratos doesn't have, it kind of creates a balance in terms of you have these two characters that without each other, they may not have been able to succeed.
Oh, cool. Okay.
Yeah, it is very much that, right? It is. Kratos needs the son just as much as the son needs his father. So I think it's really tying that mechanic into the combat experience as well to some degree, and then seeing that extend into the narrative and have players sort of really remember that, you know, in moment to moment, even in combat, being able to use him in those combos, juggling and you know, using him as needed, when needed. I think those things are things players will really remember.
Yeah.
So the traditional QuickTime events of the previous God of War games are gone, right? What drove that decision, and how will that affect when Kratos encounters boss characters?
Yeah, I think that was just a part of the big bucket of decisions of what we had to do to make this God of War feel different. Like, we made four games directly in the studio, and Ready at Dawn created two other ones. So the systems that we had in the previous game had six games worth of content of items that we chose to do for various reasons, and we wanted to see if we could pull away from some of those ideas. So first we did it with the camera by changing it. It's a free look as opposed to camera lock, and we change his weapon, and we add the sun as part of the compass system. And of course, since he's in the Norse world, a complete new suite of enemies. So the last thing was like, yeah, like those QuickTime events, if people talk about old God of War games, what do they remember? They probably remember those. So we wanted to see if we can still have Kratos do those cinematic events of him killing an enemy and doing crazy things, but instead of having a random button associated with the Kratos action, to actually make sure that whatever Kratos decides to do, it is a button that corresponds to an action that you would expect. Mm-hmm. So we still have like some cinematic kills where you would have to press certain buttons, but they're not of the random button variety. They're more of a kind of like what Jeet was talking about earlier, a concept of choice of like, oh, do you want to do this or do you want to do that? And then you have buttons associated with those actions that you learn throughout the game.
What sort of challenges did the single take camera pose to the combat system?
So this one was definitely a tough one, right? I mean, bringing the camera in so close has been a challenge across the game. Combat, narrative, moment to moment, navigation, you name it. And from a combat perspective, I think the biggest challenge has definitely just been being able to track your enemies, being able to see where you are, being able to assess the battlefield. And then, you know, what God of War is always known for is being able to take down big creatures and big enemies. And so pulling in the camera as much as we have has made us sort of have to really rethink how we want to present that to the player. And sort of what assistance do we want to provide? How much of that assistance do we want to provide in terms of tracking and providing the information that the player needs to then make those sort of tactical decisions? But on the flip side, it's also made things a lot more in your face. It's made things a lot more menacing. It's made things make you feel that you're in it. You're in the thick of things. And that sort of balances it out a little bit. I don't know if you have more to say about this.
Yeah, no, I mean, that pretty much covers it. I mean, it's one of the most challenging things this game for sure. Like our attempt to kind of move away from the camera perspective that we used to this new one. But as Jeet said, I mean, all the elements of the game in terms of like really seeing this new world closely, seeing your son up close, like all these items would have been hard to do if the camera was further out. So we are constantly working towards like making sure that we're still delivering like on, you know, similar flow of combat as previous games, but making sure that, okay, now you got to watch your back. You know, things behind you are harder to take note of. You kind of have to position yourself a little more deliberately and take more deliberate actions than you might have used to.
Yeah, definitely. It adds a whole new depth to that combat experience as opposed to just sort of your, you know, square, square, triangle. It adds a little bit of tactical, assessing the battlefield, assessing the enemies, using the sun when needed. I think it's been a great addition to that layer of combat.
Yeah, and it's the thing that I think that, you know, when out of everything that we changed, like when we changed that, that's when this game felt like a new IP to me, which is okay. Like, okay, all the things we used to do like are no longer like things that we can do anymore, like in the same way. Now that's kind of an exaggeration because we do, you know, keep the same kind of style of combat. We keep the same style of enemies and the same style of tropes that you might be used to, but we have to turn everything on its head in terms of like what you can do. So a good example of this is that previous God of Wars, you know, since the camera was so far out, we never really had a concept of aiming at an enemy in a particular location, like throwing something at his head or shooting him in his legs or things like that. But in this game, since the camera is close and you get in that kind of almost third person view when you're throwing your axe, it's like you can aim at their head, you can aim at their legs, and you can aim at like certain like parts of characters when they, you know, light up before they do attack or things like that. So it adds another kind of bit of nuance in this game that just you couldn't even do in the previous God of War games that makes it feel a lot different.
So everybody's talked about how there are no camera cuts in this game. How did that affect the combat system, and what were the challenges associated with that?
The no cut camera is definitely a huge challenge. As I mean, God of War has also been all about stringing sort of really cool combos together, stringing really cool cutscenes, and going in and out of gameplay to sort of the cinematic mode and back to gameplay and things like that. So it's made a lot of sort of the, you know, smoke and mirror tricks that you could sort of get away with when you have camera cuts. It's taken that sort of completely out the window for us. And so from a gameplay perspective, we've had to really rethink how are we going to be able to make that the sequencing of those actions seamless and feel really good. And and have it be not sort of have it be seamless to the player, so the player doesn't really notice them, but is also not annoyed by them. And so I think that has been a challenge in itself, as well as its extension to sort of just how we deliver the narrative in the game. And then, you know, like, again, God of War is all about sort of meshing those two experiences completely within, you know, like a big combat situation. You go into a nice little cinematic. You can still do some gameplay there. Then you land, and it's pure gameplay all over again. And while it has been challenging, the no-cut camera lets us make this experience feel absolutely seamless. So a lot of technical challenge, you know, a lot of the programmers, even the designers. I mean, I know even we've had so many, you know, out of all the cinematics in the game, we've had meetings about every single one of their entries and exits to be able to make sure that we can seamlessly sort of blend that gameplay to cinematic back to gameplay experience together. And everything has to be sort of meticulously discussed, you know, to a point of, you know, positions of characters, camera angles, speeds, phase in terms of, is it the left foot or the right foot? How are we going to merge that and blend that? And you multiply that by the number of characters in the scene. And so that all has been a pretty wild and fun ride, thanks to Corey.
I mean, because we've always valued trying to make sure that it felt like when Kratos does the more cinematic things that it feels like you're doing it, and it doesn't feel like you're watching a movie of him doing it. So that's why we did have like the button presses you do during the moves, and we try to make sure that whenever he did one of those, it kind of smoothly went into it. But usually that's where it would stop. Like we would be okay with like cutting during narrative or cutting during other moments. So as you were saying, all this has done is make every one of those moments that we used to take for granted, now we have to really understand, like, okay, how did Kratos get here from where he was? Did it make sense? Does this make sense? Can we do it? And it does achieve a feel for the game that I think Corey's looking mm-hmm. for, where you feel like, you know, the whole game is coming from a perspective that you can kind of understand. Like, you're never getting a cameraman's view of it from some mm-hmm. random location. Like, it always is from close to the Kratos's or Atreus's perspective. But it's one of the more fun things in the game that you have to do when you think of anything.
But it is one of those things, like, again, like, in seeing it in retrospect, it never makes you look away, is the way he describes it. And you do experience that. You do see this sort of, I'm never going to, you know, as a player experiencing this world through sort of Kratos' eyes. And it keeps you in focus in the game all the time. It has added tremendously to that delivery and that presentation of combat, of the narrative, and how we can seamlessly merge those two concepts together. So that's been really cool to see it come alive that way, even though it's been challenging.
So it sounds like you guys are doing a lot of really cool, interesting, complex things. Thank you so much for sitting down, taking time out of your day to talk.